they've described that even dogs won't go near the meat. It has such a foul odor to it.
Alaskan scientists work to solve the mystery of the stinky whale. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Tuesday, the 4th of August. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, finding a solution to the looming gas shortage in Anchorage.
There's some creative ideas out there, but the thing is, at some point, these have to go from the idea stage into reality.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by Alaska Communication Systems, converging voice, video, internet, and data applications for business. ACS connects companies from the North Slope to Ketchikan to each other and the rest of the world.
The Permanent Fund is closing the books on its first annual loss since it was established in 1976. The $30 billion balance at the end of the fiscal year shows a $6.5 billion drop in value from last year. The loss reflects the condition of one of the five worst years in the history of U.S. investment markets, dating back more than 200 years. However, Executive Director Mike Burns says it was looking worse at the bottom of the market back in March.
I think the whole financial system was very much at risk in the fall before they passed the TARP legislation. And if that had unraveled, you know, I don't know where we would have gone. But I think stabilizing the financial system has been a big step forward for us. Now the economists are saying they think the recession is over or about to end. You know, and the recession, you know, it's difficult to deal with, but we have a playbook for recessions. We've had them before. You know, you lower interest rates and you try to throw some money at it, and you know, or some variation of those two. What we haven't dealt with before was just the frozen credit markets and this financial system that just wasn't working. So all of those together, about the perfect storm.
Burns says fund managers are seeing bright spots for future investments.
What we've been moving on maybe the last 6 weeks is bad news that wasn't as bad as expected. But I think we're really starting to see some good news now. Not just that it's not as bad as we thought it might be, but it's actually better. And I think that's a big transition for us.
The final financial report will show a loss of 17.4% for the year, and Burns says that will be reflected in this year's dividend. The corporation has already transferred $874 million to be shared by Alaskans. That's more than $400 million less than last year's transfer. Alaskan biologists are working to help solve a deep mystery surrounding gray whales hunted by native groups in Chukotka, Russia. For decades, hunters have described occasionally harvesting foul-smelling whales that sickened anyone who ate the meat. In the last 10 years, the problem appears to be increasing. Now, Russian and U.S. biologists are working together to investigate the issue. APRN's Annie Feit reports.
The affected gray whales are usually called stinky because of the unusual and powerful smell on their breath and in their meat.
I don't really like the word stinky as a descriptor because it's not very scientific, but that's kind of how they've been offhandly termed.
Cheryl Rosa is a research biologist for the North Slope Borough. She just returned from a trip to Chukotka, where she took samples to study from five gray whales. Four of the whales appeared normal, but one was stinky. Rosa describes the smell as medicinal and says the meat is inedible.
People that eat them get sick from eating them. They experience anything from rashes or severe stomach aches to a numbness in their mouth upon contacting things like the blubber from these whales. They've described that even dogs won't go near the meat. It has such a foul odor to it.
The problem was first reported in the 1960s. Stinky whales were documented only sporadically until 1999, when the numbers of affected whales jumped suddenly. No one knows why. Since then, scientists have also heard reports of stinky walruses, seals, fish, and bird eggs. The Siberian Yupik and Chukchi natives in Russia, who subsist on the meat, are worried a human-made chemical in the environment is sickening the whales. But Rosa says she's interested in the idea that a biotoxin is to blame, a harmful algae.
We're very interested in if there's the potential that these whales are feeding in certain areas that may be exposing them to this type of algae. There's many different types of toxic algae. There's not just one. And trying to kind of focus down on what it is we're dealing with is possibly one of the solutions to this mystery.
Rosa is eager to study as many whales as possible to try to understand the problem. She helped deliver two large chest freezers to Chukotka so new samples of whale meat can be properly stored before they're analyzed in both countries. Rosa says the stinky odor has never been reported in bowhead whales near Alaska, but she says the North Slope Burrow has a stake in helping neighboring Russia piece together a complex puzzle.
Of course, it's very interesting to figure out what this problem is in case it is a problem for us, but we would like to lend any type of scientific aid to Russia that we can.
The stinky whale odor is so strong, often hunters can detect the smell while the whale is still swimming and avoid harvesting affected animals. But Rosa says the problem is a big concern for native groups in Chukotka because they rely so heavily on the whales in their day-to-day lives.
Gray whales form a large percentage of the diet and protein in the diet in this area, and there's not a lot of other resources there. This is not, we're talking about an area that is not like we're used to here in the United States. They don't have a lot there, and it's very important that they have this food to eat.
Rosa says she's optimistic scientists will eventually get to the bottom of the stinky whale mystery. She says so far the biggest obstacles have been finding funding for the research and getting the necessary permits to ship gray whale samples from Russia to the United States. In Anchorage, I'm Annie Feit.
A new wildfire near Fairbanks is drawing a major response. The Hard Luck Creek Fire is burning about 25 miles northwest of town near Murphy Dome. The fire has been moving quickly through volatile black spruce. It had burned 1,000 acres as of midday, but State Information Officer Pete Buist says the flames are not immediately threatening any subdivisions.
It's not near any built-up areas of Fairbanks proper. The closest place would be the Goldstream Valley, and it's a long way from there, and most of the movement's been in the other direction.
Buist says water-dropping helicopters and planes have been used to attack the flames and protect isolated cabins on the Chattanooga River.
Right now, our primary concern is remote cabins. There are some people that live there all year round, so it's not just recreational cabins, but those structures are the ones that are closest to the fire, and that's where the emphasis is right now. Obviously, we don't want that fire running up Hard Luck Creek and over Murphy Dome and up into the Goldstream Valley, but right now, the immediate concern is structures there along the Chattanooga.
Buist says more people and equipment are being put on the Hard Luck Fire, and an incident management team was assigned to it today. The cause of the fire is under investigation, but it's believed to have been started by lightning. Northeast of Fairbanks, things are looking good again today on 350,000-acre, four-fire Crazy Mountain Complex near Circle. The Bluff Creek Fire along the Steese Highway 3 miles from Circle continues to be the priority incident. State Information Officer Sarah Sarlos says a smoke conversion has limited growth and allowed crews to attack the fire on the ground. She says heavy smoke is cloaking the Riverside community of Circle.
It's a darn smoky day. It's just looking across the parking lot. Visibility is about a quarter mile. You can't look across the Yukon, put it that way.
Sarlo says the smoke has air operations shut down, including mapping of the fire perimeter. The rail belt fires west of Nenana continue to burn up acreage, challenging fire managers trying to protect structures scattered across remote country. The fires have burned more than 382,000 acres, and Information Officer Gary Lenhausen says efforts are focused on keeping the flames from more populated areas, including along the Teklanika Fire on the river on the fire's southern front.
There's 40 or 50 cabins spread along the river there, so we're concerned about the safety of those cabins right there on the river. But beyond that, if the Menno Flats South Fire gets across the Teklanika River and begins to spread to the southeast. Then there's a number of subdivisions in that area that it'll spread towards, including Anderson and Clear Air Force Base.
He says crews are also working the fire's northern front, trying to keep it from getting across the Tanana River. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, celebrating an art form that gets a lot of use in Alaska.
It's a way to articulate something visually that it's hard to put into words sometimes.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Pin Air, with 50 years of flying experience and offering charter service throughout Alaska and the United States. Details online at pinair.com.
The Senate voted yesterday to keep an energy grant program for rural areas that specifically benefits Alaska. The Agriculture Department's High Energy Cost Grant Program brings down the price of electricity in parts of the country where costs nearly triple the national average. Alaska historically gets about half of its total appropriation. President Obama wanted to eliminate the $17.5 million program, saying it duplicates a separate loan guarantee program. And he wasn't alone. Arizona Republican Senator John McCain also wanted to kill it. But the Senate voted 55-41 to keep it. Senator Lisa Murkowski advocated for the program on the floor yesterday. She says it was created to cover gaps in existing programs.
These are designed to do exactly what we're working so hard in this body to do, to improve our energy generation, our transmission, our facilities, our distribution facilities.
Murkowski says while Alaska and Hawaii are the biggest beneficiaries, a dozen other states use it and eight more are applying to participate. South Central natural gas customers are getting higher bills in the mail this month, and future rate increases could be in store. That is, unless a new source of natural gas comes online soon. Anchorage Mayor Dan Sullivan has set up a task force to do just that, find a new supply and bring it to the city as soon as possible. APRN's Ellen Lockyer has more.
Last winter, Anchorage temperatures hit the deep freeze for several weeks. That may not seem like much of a problem by Alaska bush standards, but few city folks have alternative wood-burning heat. And as outdoor temperatures plunged, indoor thermostats skyrocketed. The sudden drain on natural gas supplies by more than 130,000 residences and businesses pinpointed a problem.
We are running out of cheap, accessible cook inlet gas, and we need to make finding a new, consistent, affordable supply a top priority.
Anchorage Mayor Dan Sullivan, he says during his campaign, one issue on the table was securing a long-term energy supply for the city, and now Sullivan is focusing on that task. Last week, Sullivan announced the Energy Task Force, made up of industry and business professionals, professionals like Tony Izzo, who is the former chief of NSTAR in Anchorage and now heads TMI Consulting.
What I've seen is in the last 10 years, our deliverability, the amount of gas that's available on any given day has dropped significantly and precipitously. We've seen that reinforced in the last three winters when we have had very cold days, circumstances that came close to interrupting supplies for heat as well as power generation.
Izzo says the pressure needed to get gas into the supply line just isn't there when demand peaks during extreme cold.
There is a good amount of gas supply because it's true, it's in there. But getting it out on those really cold days when people need it the most is similar to trying to breathe through a single straw. There just isn't enough pressure pushing it out, and there's not enough deliverability is the word or the definition of in terms of how much we can get on a single day when we need it.
Izzo says there are known gas reserves in Cook Inlet, but the amount of investment needed to develop them is significant. Sullivan says time is running out, and Anchorage has to move forward, but is the price right?
Having a reliable supply is probably worth a higher price.
Although Anchorage has grown to some 280,000 people this past decade, it is still considered a small market, and that may not be attractive to producers.
It's estimated that there are still some significant reserves there, at least enough for, well, maybe 15 to 20 years of use, but the people that produce it would like a higher price because basically Anchorage is not that big a market, and it's hugely expensive to go be drilling, particularly when you've already exhausted maybe the large, easy-to-find fields. So we'll probably be looking at higher prices. I think the RCA, the Regulatory Commission, may have to look at granting some higher price structures in order to stimulate drilling out there.
And a wobbly energy supply could drive away potential business development in Anchorage. Sullivan says the task force will consider all options.
You know, some of the other options that have been talked about are literally bringing in a liquefied natural gas tanker and parking it in Cook Inlet and having it feed into the system. There's some creative ideas out there, but the thing is, at some point, these have to go from the idea stage into reality.
Of course, the task force will monitor progress toward a natural gas pipeline from the North Slope, but the panel is eyeing other options, like the abundant hydropower available just across the inlet, or even coal, if the concept of truly clean coal becomes a reality, Sullivan says. For now, he says residents can help out by being energy conscious.
One thing that we can do immediately, and we will be working on a game plan to let the public know how to conserve energy, because you can save 20-30% almost instantly with conservation measures, as Juneau found out when the snowslide knocked out their main power source. They were forced to conserve because the price of the alternative energy was so high that basically they tightened the belts, turned on the thermostats, and saved an awful lot of energy, and we can do that too.
Izzo echoes the need for conservation, and the former NSTAR CEO says there is a chance that natural gas bills will drop come January. He says Alaska gas prices, the highest in the country now, trail national trends, and prices in the lower 48 are actually on the decline. He says Anchorage's supply problem is unique because of the lack of connection to major markets outside. For APRN, I'm Ellen Lockyer.
A Fairbanks-based nonprofit has tapped local knowledge to build a climate-specific home in Anaktuvik Pass. The Cold Climate Housing Research Center director, Jack Hebert, says the project mixes 21st-century technology with traditional sod house construction.
The traditional home was an earth-sheltered sod building, small, but very energy efficient and really out of the wind, and that worked for the people there. So we took that concept with what their needs are now and worked on a design.
The goal of the project was to build a one-story, 1,000-square-foot home for $150,000 in the remote village, where it can cost more than $1 million to fly in and build a conventional stick-frame house. Hebert says the project home employed innovative wall and roof construction.
The design of the house incorporates very light steel stud structure with an interior plywood skin and then an extruded or spray-applied soy-based urethane for a very energy efficiency envelope with a elastomeric membrane sprayed on the outside of that and then sod and earth over that again.
Hebert says the home is designed to use just 110 gallons of oil a year compared to the 1,400 gallons the average Anaktuvik Pass home currently consumes. A family will live in the new home, and the structure will be monitored for performance as part of what's called the Sustainable Northern Shelter Program. Similar projects are in the works for other areas of the state so that a catalog of region-specific plans and material lists can be made available to the public.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by BP. Giving back to the community is a priority because so many at BP call Alaska home. Working late? Hear Alaska News Nightly at any time of the day on the web at www.aprn.org.
Alaska State Troopers say it's too early to determine how a woman fell off a cruise ship near Juneau early Monday. Holland America Line spokeswoman Sally Andrews says the death appears to be a suicide and no foul play is suspected. But Trooper spokeswoman Megan Peters says that's not yet clear.
much at this time, troopers have not come to a conclusive determination. What we are doing, though, is we're requesting that the state medical examiner conduct an autopsy to see if that will shed any more light on the circumstances surrounding her death. We spent the day conducting interviews and reviewing some of the evidence, but we still think it's premature at this time to come to a determination.
The body of 45-year-old Amber Malko was found Monday afternoon on the west side of Douglas Island near Alaska's capital city. The Arlington, Washington woman was a passenger on the cruise ship Zandam, which was sailing from Juneau to Glacier Bay. The Coast Guard and state troopers investigated the death while the ship was in Sitka today.
There were some security tapes. We have some photographs that were taken that does indicate that she did, in fact, get back on the boat in Juneau. We had identified some people that had contact with her that night to see, just talk to them to see if there was anything going on that we should be aware of and the like.
Malko was reported missing by a traveling companion Monday morning when the ship was in Glacier Bay, about 75 miles northwest of Juneau. The woman was last seen when she ordered room service the previous night. Her body was recovered after a search stretching more than 80 miles of ocean and shoreline. The Zandam is on a 7-night cruise out of Seattle that began Friday. Four totem poles were raised in Heidelberg this past weekend. KRBD's Jay Marble attended one of the events and has this story.
On one of the hottest days of the year, people lined up on both sides of the pole, grabbed onto the 4x4 handles, and packed those poles all the way from the dock to the totem park. Over and over, the pole was lifted, carried away, and set down on A-frames. And when the times between the carrying was a bit too long, the drumming and dancing would kick in. The walk was long enough that those doing the heavy lifting, the kids who got to ride on the pole, the drummers and dancers who performed along the way, and the crowd that watched all started to change color in the intense sun. Some shifted towards a deep brown, others towards a bright red. It was slow going, and in some parts, especially going uphill, those doing the carrying had a lot of encouragement. One staple that was in big demand for this event was bottled water. Those doing the carrying of the pole were burning a lot of calories, and they were sweating. As the procession moved up the road towards the school and the totem park, a trail of plastic bottles followed the carriers. There were several rest stops made along the way, but not all were planned. More than once, the rough-cut 4x4s being used to support the pole snapped, and a runner would have to go find more. Once the sharp turns into the park were made, the pole was placed on A-frames, and long lines were tied on, run down the hill and into the road. As those on the pole lifted, the crews on the ropes pulled.
All the way above your head! Lift! Up!
Wait, hold!
Go straight up. Straight up on this
end. Okay.
Hey,
lift! Fire! In an operation like this, there's a lot of minor adjustments that get made. A little trimming of the creosote base pole with a chainsaw, and putting people with particular body types in the right places. Then the slack went out of the ropes, and in a matter of seconds, the pole was up. After some last-minute alterations to the creosote post and some delicate twisting, the base pole and the totem pole merged. A large hole was drilled through both, and a bolt was run through. This process was repeated until four poles were raised. I'm Jay Marble.
Homer Photo Fest 2009 starts today in Homer. It celebrates the art of photography through lectures, workshops, and juried exhibits. Top photographers from Alaska and around the country will share their expertise with participants. KBBI's Marsha Lynn recently talked with some of the visiting photographers about their love of the art form and how it's evolved over the years.
Keith Carter is from Texas and has spent four decades doing what he terms making photos. He says this is the reason why.
It's a way to articulate something visually that it's hard to put into words sometimes. And it puts you in positions to see and participate in either landscapes or cultural events that you might not find yourself in had you not been there to chronicle it in some way.
Carter will give an afternoon workshop and an evening lecture sharing material from his newest book, which was released 6 months ago. Ted Orland from Santa Cruz, California, wants to share a retrospective on his work and how it's evolved over the years.
Began working with large format and studying with people like Ansel Adams, and then slowly realizing that I really didn't lead a large format, fine-grained life, and began to sort of downshift my expectations or my hopes for photography a little bit until I reached the point where I just wanted to make the line between my life and my art as short and straight as possible. And so I got a little plastic camera, which has one f-stop, one shutter speed, and you can focus on a mountain or a bunch of people or a head. And that's it. It takes all of the other considerations out of the equation. There is nothing between you and the thing you want to see.
Landscape photography is what Barry McWain of Fairbanks loves and says his talk will reflect how his views on the subject have changed.
And that was the concept that it was not really possible to make consequential images or images of import unless you got yourself far from the madding crowd, way out off the road and into the high mountains or the distant land. And how over the course of time in my career, I first, you know, settled on that idea and incorporated it. And then I began to fight it and realize that images that I made from or near the roadways, in particularly here but elsewhere, were every bit as valid and every bit as meaningful to me about the land as those that I made when I walked, you know, dozens of miles into the wilderness.
As their photography careers have progressed, the technology has evolved a great deal. The three men reflect on those changes.
I think that photography is in a somewhat tumultuous realignment right now, and we all pretty much agree with that. But I think it's very exciting, both technologically and visually.
Photography traditionally was the most experiential of the arts. You literally had to be there to make the photograph. And that may be changing a little bit now as people appropriate images off the web or find that instead of going to Nepal and climbing a large mountain, they simply get a picture of a large mountain and put themselves on top of it in the computer and they're done. And I think sometimes the peril is that you end up making photographs of experiences you never quite had.
I sold all of my film cameras in 2000. But what I've discovered is that I can maintain the meaningful aesthetic that I have built up over the years and make satisfying images with the new technology and, in fact, embrace it and learn things that it can do that the film technology I used for many, many years can't do now.
These artists will join a number of others as part of the Photo Fest, which takes place at Homer's Alaska Ridgetop Inn and runs through Saturday, August 8th. In Homer, I'm Marsha Lynn.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at APRN.org. We had reports tonight from Dan Bross in Fairbanks, Ed Schoenfeld in Juneau, Jay Marble in Heidelberg, and Marsha Lynn in Homer. APRN's Libby Casey reported from Washington, D.C., and Dave Donaldson from Juneau. Our editor and producer is Annie Fite. Our audio engineer is Gooseberry Peter. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by GrantStation, your fast track to funding on the web at grantstation.com, serving Alaskan organizations for over 10 years. And by First National Bank Alaska, working shoulder to shoulder with Alaskan businesses for nearly a century. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.